Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and I'm here with Tom Jackman, who's a crime and courts reporter for the Washington Post, and also I know he does an adjunct class over at George Mason University.
That's right. I am a high-ranking member of academia, Jason. I have a class at George Mason called Media Coverage of Criminal Justice.
Okay, cool.
Which I think this is going to come up, although I don't know what to do if a student doesn't have Netflix.
Ooh, that's true. Do you give them a free subscription?
I don't know. Yeah, I give them my login? You know, do we have to make them watch 10 hours?
Ooh, that is tricky.
So I'm still pondering that. The class starts next week, and I'm still crafting my intellectual syllabus. But anyway, I do teach that and have for a number of years.
Okay,
and,
cool.
And I've been covering the courts and cops for about 30 years now between here and the Kansas City Star.
Okay, cool. We obviously want to talk about Making a Murderer, and obviously there's been, the Jinx as well. All the true crime stuff is suddenly all the rage now. You can't go through social media without seeing people posting about these true crime shows. Why do you think now? I mean, 60 Minutes and all the, stuff like that, Unsolved Mysteries, all that stuff has been around a while, but why do you think this is exploding now? Is it that it's long form? Is it presented as entertainment? Why is it, you think?
I think there's a combination of the fact that people now have the ability to spend more time on things like Serial, a podcast with numerous episodes, but lots and lots of people have spent the time with it. And Making a Murderer is 10 hours. It's more than 10 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And the word binge watch didn't used to be in our vocabulary, and now it is. And combine that with the true life things that have been happening, starting with the case in Ferguson and the case in Baltimore, and the case in Staten Island, and the case in South Carolina, and the case in Cleveland, where there's video that has gotten people talking and social media ginned up over these things. And so between what's going on in the real world and the fact that people are now willing to take the time to sit down with the entertainment side of it, if you want to call it entertainment, there's just much more of a receptiveness in the public to see this stuff that a lot of us have been doing for a long time, just sort of in short form.
Right. I know I followed your coverage. It was the John Gear case, right?
Right.
You've seen that sort of take off, at least from a journalism side, of people following that story and your coverage in it. But talk about how once it reaches the level of a pop culture phenomenon like the Stephen Avery case here in Making a Murderer, suddenly that we're seeing, there was a giant petition for the White House to look into the case and maybe pardon him. The White House responded and said, sorry, not going to do it. Is there a lament by a reporter like you that, it almost takes a show like this to get that many people suddenly involved? It's like, why weren't you guys caring about this case before? Is there a lament on that, or is it more just, hey, it's people are finally discovering it?
It is, sort of, in that, this Avery case has been, that trial was in 2007.
Yeah.
The crime was committed in 2005. There's a large intervening time there, and the filmmakers have even said, it's a good thing it took us so long to make this, because by the time we were ready, the world was ready, and the world wasn't ready for a long time, but now the audience is there. They originally pitched it to HBO and to PBS, who both passed on it. And then Serial and The Jinx came out, Serial, a radio podcast, and Jinx, an HBO show, and that created a demand for more. And so, social media, just in these last 3 or 4 years, I think more and more people have gotten on it that are willing to run with these cases and talk about them and hash them out and dissect them on Reddit or wherever. And then that leads to the mainstream and other media writing more about the case. And so where once you could Google Stephen Avery and mainly find just articles that have been written in Wisconsin, now they're from every angle of the news media and alternative media and social media. It's everywhere where, for many, many years, the Avery case was only known to the people in that part of the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. So I assume you've watched all 10 episodes, right?
I have.
Okay, how long? First of all, how long did it take you to knock it out? I think I was done in a weekend.
I don't have those skills, and so I probably about a week and a half. I do have two kids,
right.
And so it had to be done late at night.
Not something you can watch with the kids.
It's not, in part because, you know, a lot of it is dry. It's just courtroom testimony,
right.
And so it's not, but it's also a horrible story and a tragic thing that happened to Teresa Halbach, and and as a member of the media, I always try to, you know, keep a focus on the victim and remember them. And we often lose sight of that when discussing, you know, the merits of a case against an accused murderer. We need to recall the victim, too. And so I still feel bad for her and her family.
Yes, definitely. How do you, you know, try to put on the filmmaker's hat if you were, you know, the folks that, that made this sucker. I believe it was written, directed by Laura
Ricciardi.
Ricciardi and Maura Demos.
Right.
When they set out to tell this thing, you know, most every documentary has somewhat of an agenda behind it. I mean, if you're trying, you know, Thin Blue Line, he's trying to get the guy exonerated.
Right.
Or a Michael Moore movie, what, you know, whatever it is.
Sure.
You know, but what's sort of the responsibility of, you know, do you view something like this as something where the, you know, the filmmaker should try to be objective, or is it okay to be have a little subjectivity to it? And in this case, do you think agenda sounds harsh, but you know what I'm getting at?
I think agenda is a good word, and there are different, you know, groups of people that make these things, and so journalists, mainstream media journalists anyway, the evil mainstream media, we're not supposed to have an agenda. We're supposed
right.
to play it down the middle.
Right.
But an independent filmmaker, filmmakers in this case, like these women from New York, they're, you know, allowed to adopt any agenda they want if they can sell it, and as long as they're transparent about it. Now, in this case, they have said, we just went to Wisconsin because we thought it was an interesting story, and we wanted to tell it. And that is sort of a journalistic outlook. The problem being that they then sort of embedded with one side, that being the defense, and the story is largely presented from the defense point of view. And they, you know, they talked to the defendant, Stephen Avery, after trial every day
right.
on the phone, and they had incredible access to the defense, but they didn't have access to the other side, and the other side is now saying, well, there's parts they left out of the the film. Well, that's their prerogative as filmmakers. They can put in or leave out what they want.
Right.
And the all the strictures that journalists abide by about fairness and objectivity and fair and balanced, I don't know that that necessarily applies to folks who make films for HBO or Frontline or Netflix. They do come at it with a perspective, and that's usually known. And we know it here that they wound up with this perspective, though I think they still deny that. I think they would claim that they were still just trying to present the case objectively.
Right, right. Well, as someone who covers it all the time, you know, and as someone who's watched the whole show and familiar with it now, I mean, what do you, I'm not going to say, what side do you come down on? Do you think he's guilty or innocent? Because obviously that's something that you and I really will never know.
Right.
For sure. But, you know, what do you think, at least, let's phrase it this way then, you know, what do you think was the most compelling arguments from the defense? And then conversely, maybe some stuff that could have maybe gotten left out that maybe the prosecution might have had more strength in their argument?
I thought the most compelling thing for the defense was that this was supposedly a horrible, vicious murder, and there's virtually no trace of it, you know, in the house, in the garage, or, you know, small, minor traces, which they found.
You mean, or in the bedroom where she was supposedly tied down, yeah.
Correct. For as horrible as this attack was made out to be, you know, the evidence is mighty sparse, and the confessions that came from the teenage nephew did not look on the up and up to a lot of people. So those would be the big you know, talking points for the defense. And, you know, the prosecutors, as a result of that, didn't use the teenager at all in the Avery case. They just used those confessions against him in his own case. For the prosecution, they would point out, you know, all right, you claim that we, you know, stole blood from the evidence in the first case and planted it in Teresa's car. Well, how did we get DNA? You know, how did we get DNA inside of the hood of her car, and how did we get DNA on her key, and how did we get her key, and how did it get there?
Right.
So I thought that those were Those are pretty tough. And also, it's not clear to me if this ever made it into evidence or not, but Teresa had been to that house before and had been a little bit spooked by Avery, and he had specifically called and asked for her to come back and had used the Star 67 phone trick to conceal his identity in making the call for her to return to their property.
And that's not in the show.
Correct. And I don't know if it was in the trial or not. Some of it is, some of it isn't. It was covered pretty closely by the media in Milwaukee and Green Bay at the time, very closely. And so it wasn't like any of this was being done in the dark. And all the players were known, and their backgrounds were known, and the fact that they were in the midst of a civil suit, all of that was known. So there was not a lot that was hidden from either side. The cards were on the table.
For sure. And just speaking, going right along with what you're saying about how the media was right there and not much was held. I mean, they show in Making a Murderer that each day after trial, it's like the both attorneys for the defense and prosecution come out and give statements to the reporters, some with furrowed brows, like saying that doesn't add up. They're really grilling them there in the show. But how widespread is that?
That's not widespread.
That's what I was going to say. I don't think
that
usually
unusual.
Happens. What? Talk about why you think that happened in this case, and is that even ethical?
It's questionable. It happened in the Sniper case, right? So we're down in Chesapeake for the Malvo case, and the defense would come out each day and talk to us in the tent outside the courthouse. But that was because there were no cameras in the courtroom.
Right.
Here, there were cameras in the court, so I don't know why, what excuse the media had for, grilling them again when things had already been done in court. As a reporter, I'm happy to have access to the lawyers and have them answering questions after court each day. That's a fantastic thing for the media. We'll take it every time. But should they be commenting on the evidence during a trial is questionable and doesn't happen very often.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I'm sure the filmmakers were happy that it was allowed as well.
Sure. And the lawyers would sit there and watch each other as they spoke to the media. The defense lawyers would watch the prosecutors be questioned, and then the defense lawyers would step up, and vice versa. And so they were, they were managing their message outside the courtroom as well as inside.
Definitely. Do you expect there to be any, going forward from this? I mean, now that the White House has sort of, declined the petition and everything, what further traction do you see this perhaps having?
Well, the White House was never really a viable option because it's not a federal case.
Right.
So a president can't pardon somebody in a state case. It has to be the governor. The governor of Wisconsin is Scott Walker. He seems unlikely to intervene. The other thing that kind of gets forgotten is that this case has been through a lot of the appeals courts already because it's old. And a lot of journalists would probably have tried to get this film made and out a lot earlier while the appeals were still happening. So, but he has, as a result of this film, been represented now by an Innocence Project group of lawyers who are taking on the case in federal court. And federal courts can get involved and can overturn habeas appeals, and so it's still possible, even years later, and we're now 8-plus years down the road from the trial, that it's the federal courts could intervene, but they would have to find error by the judge or error by the lawyers. They can't just... I don't think that there's a case to be made there for actual innocence. I think you have to do it the standard appeals route, which is to say the judge messed this up, we need a new trial, or the prosecutors did X and we need a new trial.
Absolutely. Well, you said you didn't see the Jinx. Did you listen to Serial?
I did not.
Okay.
Sorry. I've heard that they've talked about some of my stories in there because
sure.
I wrote about the use of cell tower technology to find people after the fact, and they've apparently discussed that, or I guess early in a couple of different episodes of Serial, I talked about my stories. Interesting is that Netflix now enters as a possible player. PBS and HBO were the likely places to go for these kind of things, but now you've got Netflix willing to produce a 10-hour show, and this would seem to me that indicate that Amazon could get in the game. They've got their own distribution network. They're out there winning Golden Globes and,
yeah, right and left.
And Emmys. So they're, you know, producing entertainment. Why not produce their own hit documentary? So there's more outlets for it, which is good from a journalistic point and a viewer point. And there's also a willingness for people to watch 10 hours or to listen to however many hours Serial is. There's a much more expanded expectation in the audience that they can get more. In fact, the Washington Post did a story on Making a Murderer, and when it talked about things that weren't included, it said, well, there's only so much you can fit into 10 hours.
Right.
But wow, really? If you can't fit it into 10 hours, really, you can't fit it.
Yeah,
10 exactly. hours is a lot.
Exactly. Are you, speaking of those 10 hours, and you mentioned earlier that, you know, admittedly, some of it's dry because it's a lot of, you know, stuff in the courtroom. But
right.
As someone who's been in the courtroom a lot, and you know, I'm sure it wasn't that dry to you because you know you live and breathe that stuff a lot.
Right.
But, you know, take me through sort of your experience watching through those 10 hours. Did you find it, you know, gripping towards the start? Because they do a lot of cliffhangers with the key in the room and then suddenly cut
right.
to the credits. Or,
right.
Or, you know, the big one is the vial of Avery's blood that seems to have a hole in the front, in the top that, you know. In terms of how they structured the series, take me through in terms of, you know, how you think it was structured.
I thought it was brilliant filmmaking, in mm-hmm. part because they had exceptional access to the players involved, which 99% of the time are not going to allow the media into your defense meetings where you're talking about the case, you're strategizing about the case. That's fantastic behind-the-scenes insight. Then you're with the family, they're going to the jail, and you're talking to the defendant every day.
Yeah.
These are things that reporters typically don't have. And they benefited by the fact that they were not the mainstream media. They came in and they were not putting every last word on the 6 o'clock news. In fact, they filmed and filmed for years, and nobody saw a single second of it.
Yeah.
And so they had great access and were able to parlay that into a really compelling story. Now, what would have happened if they'd also had access to the prosecution side and could have sat in on those strategy meetings and could have heard the other side, the explanation side?
Right.
Well, boy, that would have been the best thing ever. But would we have needed 20 hours? I don't know. 20 hours is a lot. But that would be the whole story. And that's what we're looking for.
That would be the ideal way to do it, yeah.
Yeah.
Are you? I know you said you didn't see The Jinx, but are you somewhat familiar with it? And let's say Making a Murderer, with the filmmakers, let's say, agenda is still ongoing, obviously. They're trying to plead this case for someone who's still locked away.
Right.
The Jinx, man, by the end of that thing, they pretty much get him to incriminate himself on camera.
How many episodes is it?
It's only 6, so I think you could knock it out. And it's you know, I'd say, as a viewer, if you want to view this as entertainment, let's say,
right.
It's definitely more closure by the end. It's pretty, by that last episode, you're pretty blown away at what they've got Robert Durst to say. But I don't want to give away too much.
Well, and this is also a case that had, how much media coverage had that gotten prior to, you know, these filmmakers getting involved with him?
Well, I mean,
I thought it had gotten some.
Years ago, in the disappearance of his wife up in New York, there was a lot of coverage, but it had died down for about a couple decades, and then there was another, you know, it sort of got a second life in the press around the time of a second murder as well, years later, out in California. But yeah, no, to your point, when The Jinx came out, I believe it was rolled out, you know, over a series of weeks on HBO, and I think Durst was arrested right the night before the final episode ran. So is there a benefit or a danger or a little of both that some of this can play out almost as much in the court of public opinion as it does in the actual court?
Well, you know what it may do is, and they've talked about this in courts for years, is the CSI effect, where jurors expect that there will be blood and there will be DNA and there will be fingerprints and there will be physical evidence in every case, and it will all wrap up neatly at the 57-minute mark. And so prosecutors and defense lawyers have to explain to juries in trials all the time, don't expect what you see on CSI or one of these other shows. This is real life. It doesn't happen like that. And so I could see that shows like this will create an expectation that there is you know, there is a lot behind the scenes that we're not seeing. You know, we're what kind of statements have been taken, who's filming what, you know, what miniseries is going to spin out of this case, what kind of, and then just a lot of expectations perhaps created by the fact that, this case may be way more complicated, and jurors starting to look behind the facts presented to them. And that's always been the fear of prosecutors and defense lawyers, is that people's learned assumptions from watching the media will make them think things they shouldn't think, or make them do things they shouldn't do because of what they've seen in TV. And now what do the jinx and what do making a murderer make the public or jurors expect from the police and the prosecutors? I don't know.
Definitely. Did you ever see The Thin Blue Line, the Errol Morris movie?
I sure did when it first came out.
I believe it was almost not even considered for, you know, best documentary type awards. I might have not even been nominated because they weren't sure what to do about the reenactments. It was like no one had done that before. Now everybody does that.
Right. And there was a guy, Errol Morris, who brought his own viewpoint to things, you know, legitimately or not. He was... you know, taking a hard look at that case and looking at what seemed to be a wrongful conviction. And there's something to be said for that. Not everybody has to be a boring journalist. You know, some people can be crusaders and you know, try to win the public to their side. And eventually that film carried the day.
Yeah, got a guy off death row.
Absolutely.
So there, I mean, right there, I mean, say no more. There's the power of this sort of filmmaking right there. It actually has an impact. Yeah, definitely. Awesome. Let's see, looking forward, are you going to be watching the another true crime court case? They're doing that O.J. Simpson show now, too.
That's right. I'm in.
You gonna
I'm
check
in for that
one
all
out?
The way. Yeah, absolutely.
Awesome. I believe, I mean, that's slightly different. I believe that's more of like a fictionalized, you know, narrative account of it, but... it's all the rage these days. So we appreciate you taking the time to join us. We really appreciate it. And thanks for
sure, man. Great talking to you.